I'm Pat Rushford, and the title of this session is Cancer Only Happens to Other People. I'd kind of like to start by finding out how many of you have actually had cancer yourselves or have had it in a close, real close member of the family. Okay, we have some real experienced people. Okay, I have two different methods here. I have some things that I would like to share with you and just give you some ideas and then open it up as to what my situation is. I have had cancer. I had a malignant melanoma, which I had to have a radical excision of. And so it isn't really a stranger to me. And interestingly enough, before this came about, I belonged to a prayer group back home in Vancouver. And in that prayer group, several years ago, one of the girls had a radical mastectomy. And in fact, well, she had one breast removed, and then the next year had to have the other one removed. And then just last year, another one of the girls in my prayer group had to have a radical mastectomy. And another thing that is interesting, in the same prayer group, I have a friend who is in a hospice. And we are conspiring at this time to do a book called Christians in Crisis. So even before I found out about my cancer, I had had a lot of background and a lot of grieving with and through my friends. The week before the doctor called me to notify me of my malignant melanoma, a very good friend of mine, I found out that her 16-year-old daughter had cancer of the pelvic bone. So I felt kind of surrounded by it, and I thought, wow, you know, this is really crazy. And so when the doctor called and told me I'd better sit down, I thought, you know, what's going on here? So what it actually involved was a 5-inch radical excision of a melanoma in the lower abdomen. And there's probably a 90% chance that it could ever come back again. But the idea, the feeling that, you know, my body has produced cancer cells, and I'm very young, and I could, you know, develop cancer again and anywhere. So it's a real threat. And it was an interesting experience to go through. I'd like to share what came out of it, and then I'd like to share some things that that I think we need to be very aware of when dealing with cancer patients, or that you need to, you know, to be aware of in dealing with cancer, if it's in yourself or, you know, in your own body. I wrote a brief expose on cancer just shortly after, in fact, I think it was the day after I'd come home. And I'd like to share that with you now. Cancer, you are fearful. Human minds are overwhelmed by your destructive power. The threat of your existence brings thoughts of death, for it often follows close behind your invasion. But cancer, there are many times you do not get your way. Through the miracle of medicine, the miracle of God, your army of cells is defeated. You fall helpless, rendered harmless for a time. Cancer, you have chosen to invade this child of God. You have come a silent enemy seeking to gain control. But you are found out. The surgeon's knife and the hand of God forced you to go. They cut you out, leaving your mark on the surface of my flesh to remind me of your presence and your power. You sought to bring me to my knees in fear and remorse. Although I mourned at the loss of a part of God's creation, I shed my tears in human response. I have not been overcome. For weeping endures for the night, but joy comes in the morning. You have failed to conquer here. Cancer, you may come again to maim this vulnerable frame, but I will not fall fainting to your will. The spirit of the living God is intertwined with mine, and the strength brought forth to face you is of God. Were I left alone to face your threat, I would merely crumble, stumbling pitifully to the grave. But you, Cancer, are of the world. You conquer worldly things. I am filled with God, and greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world. In time, you may destroy my earthly body to the point of death. Still, Cancer, you will not win, for even in death I am victorious. In death, I come face to face with God. In death, I have life. That kind of gives you an idea of how I feel about cancer in myself. And there's a couple of other things that I wanted to share with you, just in things that I have written as a nurse and in dealing with cancer patients. I was a pediatric nurse for some time, and before that I worked in a veterans hospital. This one is one that I wrote after taking care of a young man who had cancer. He's dying, Lord. He wants to talk to me. I don't think I can. I don't know what to say. Lord, you know how easily I cry. My tears will just get in the way. Okay, Lord, if you insist. It seems you've given me this time, but what do you say to a dying man who's only 29? I sat with him as he bared his heart. Silently I wept with him. I couldn't speak. I found nothing to say. Words would have gotten in the way. He touched my hand and thanked me for my wisdom and my time. I hadn't said a word, and yet he knew I understood and cared enough to let him work it through. Thank you, Lord, for tears and knowing I can't talk and cry at the same time. Another one that I had written, and this was in my pediatric nursing, was when a child dies, it's really pretty rugged, and so I had a little baby that died in my arms. He lies so quiet in my arms, no movement, no breath. I'll just hold him close, one more time, for me. He's gone to be with you, Lord. I know that's where babies go. But in my grief, I must go on to one last thread of hope. I'm not ready to acknowledge he's really gone this time. We didn't expect he would survive. Someone had given up a long time ago. I prayed, Lord, but he died. I know someday I'll realize a blessing in this time, but right now, I only want to hold him one more time for me. Okay, I've got a couple more, but I won't read them right now. What I want to talk about just a little bit is the emotions that are involved with dealing with cancer and the person who has it. Dealing with it when you have it yourself. There are certain feelings that we go through. Maybe the first one would be shock. The feeling that I can't believe this is happening to me. Then I suppose there's suffering with crying and moaning and maybe even screaming at God, you know, why is this happening to me? The thing with grief is it has to be worked out, and each person has grief in their own way. Some people suffer very, you know, silently. Some people talk a lot. And by talking a lot, I think that is one of the most important things, is talking about your grief and talking about your suffering with other people helps to to set it straight in your own mind. And it's a very beneficial way to work out the grief. And I think right now I'll stop with that and see if you have any other ideas about expressing grief, because I think that is such an important part of the whole thing. How to express grief, how you feel about expressing your feelings to other people, and how you feel when other people express these feelings to you. Things you might think about is if you're really proud and don't want people to know that you're suffering, they're not going to be able to help you if you don't tell them. Honesty is very important. Being able to say, "I need you right now," you know, opening yourself up and saying, "I can't help you. I can't give you anything. I have to take right now. That's all that I can do." And I'll just put those out to you and see if you have anything to say, any comments. Mm-hmm. She's one of the people in my prayer group.
Yeah. I bet Marie Snelling is another one.
Yeah.
We're from Vancouver.
Are you the people who are supposed to look me up for Lorraine?
Pardon?
Lorraine, you know Lorraine Snelling.
Yeah.
Yeah, she told me someone was coming up here.
Yeah. We're from Bethel Church.
Oh, great. Yeah. Dottie is
she's remarkable,
a real sufferer. Yeah, she has been through a lot, and she's one of the most prominent people in my life as far as the attitude that I've been able to have about cancer and overcoming it, and the attitude that I have about, you know, death and suffering in general. Dottie was through the two surgeries for cancer, and then not too long after that she had a brain tumor, which was not malignant, but set her back a long way. She's a speaker, and she works a lot with the with people who have breast cancer in the community. And to top everything else off, she lost her son, one of her sons. So she's been through a lot.
Pat, I was thinking on grieving. What I've noticed, from where I was working, is that a lot of people in our society right now want to go through a real quick grieving process. Mm-hmm. Where, and I notice even myself, when something's happened to me, I think I should get over it sooner. Or I should still feel the pain, or it shouldn't still bother me, or I shouldn't still cry. Or really, it's such a fast-paced culture.
Everything
that
is
we
fast.
Live in, you know, and you want the quick cure for everything. You want aspirin now, and you want this and that.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of people are facing now, is trying to get over grieving too fast so that it never completely gets worked out, and
mm-hmm.
then having a lot of problems later because it eventually just builds up and it has to work out sometimes.
It's an unresolved
process,
grief.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really important to allow your body and your when your body undergoes some kind of a loss, whether it's the loss of a loved one or the loss of a part of your own body, there's a grieving process that takes place, and unless you allow that to happen, you will have what we call unresolved guilt. I know for myself, I had several days of just crying because I had lost a part of my body, and it wasn't so much, you know, that important. I mean, you can't even see it, but it was there, and I realized it was there. And knowing that this is a part of the grieving process, I was able to cry. I was able to just be what I was, a mess. <You know? laughs> And that's okay. That's okay, because when you're that way, then God is very close to you, and you know that, and you just lean on him. You know, you don't do anything for anybody. You just lean on him completely, and you just leave it up to him to get you through that. And he does. He brings you through it beautifully, and brings you through it in a healing way, so that that you're able to talk about it, that you're able to accept it, and accept it as a part of, okay, this has happened to me, and I will do with it what I can. I will, you know, apparently this has happened for a reason. I will become stronger because of it. But you don't think about that when you're grieving. You just need to have that time to get over it, to heal.
I think it's wonderful the way you can look at it. We lost two rather close friends in our hometown of cancer. First, a woman who was very well liked in the whole community. It wasn't very long after, it wasn't so many months after she died, he became down with it. And I sort of looked at it with anger. That's terrible old cancer. To me, it just seemed like an anger in me that two very dear friends should die of this horrible thing.
And that's a very natural response. And another thing that I could comment on is that a lot of people feel anger. They're angry toward God. They're angry toward cancer itself. They're just angry that this could happen. They're angry that God could allow this to happen. This is an okay thing to feel, and I think a lot of Christians kind of stiffen up at this because it is a negative way of thinking, but the negatives are okay as long as they lead you ultimately back to God and you realize that that you really need him because of these feelings that you're having. You realize how dependent you are on God. So I know my friend who is in the hospice, when we talk about expressing negative feelings, we're very open to negative feelings because it's a way of venting, it's a way of expressing your grief, and eventually that turns around, even if you don't think it does, you know. Your anger probably isn't so deep-seated now, and you probably feel, you know, better about it.
Well, I didn't feel angry to God. It was that horrible disease. When our son died some years ago, suddenly, someone told me, well, he's better off than we are. He knew the Lord. Well, that was a real consolation to me, and that's the way I feel about anyone dying of anything. Mm-hmm. If they know the Lord right, they're better off than we are.
A little over 4 years, I had a major surgery. I guess as I think back, I don't really ever remember having a grief period. I can remember before the surgery, I was just scared still. But when it was over, it was just a marvel of joy for life than anything. I just felt so much
relieved.
Relief and thankfulness that I could be alive. Mm-hmm.
Pat, as a nurse, you have had people, I don't know how long you've been in nursing, I've been in 50 years, and you've had people all these years leaning on you. Did you find it difficult to realize that all of a sudden you were leaning? This was my problem.
I might have had trouble with that if I hadn't had the support that I did. With my prayer group, we leaned on each other a lot. So it wasn't hard for me to just let go and let somebody else take care of me or let somebody else counsel me or console me.
I think that does happen to a lot of medical people.
Yeah, I think so.
And other types of helping professional type people that always are the giver. Mm-hmm.
And it is hard. It is hard not to continue to give, even when you... it's hard to break down. And I know even a lot of times when I've dealt with patients, I felt a lot of grief, and it's like you want to keep a stiff upper lip, you know, you're very strong, and you feel that you have to be strong.
Well, this is the role you played for so many years that you can't all of a sudden.
It's the role I played when my father died. Mm-hmm. I was very strong. And
But still you're healing.
Yes. Definitely. Oh, yes.
You have to have your mind where you're not going to hold up your life.
Sometimes in a situation like that, you remain strong for a certain period of time, and then you go through your grief period. Eventually, you know, sooner or later, you have to go through that grief period. You can block it out or push it back, but sooner or later, it has to come out.
I think one of the most important things you said before was that just listening to someone who has cancer or is dying. When my grandfather died, the Lord made it possible for him to go to the hospital where I was going to the university, and it was a long ways away from the family. And I would just stop over to see him in the evening or whenever, going to school and working, and got to spend just time sitting with him while he was sleeping. And it was a real comfort to him to have someone there, even though maybe I was sleeping. It was just being with someone. It was interesting for me to watch, because I would be there almost every day all week, and on the weekends the relatives would come, sons and daughter-in-laws and his wife, and they were always trying to do something for him, because they couldn't accept this fact that he was uncomfortable and there wasn't anything they could do for him.
Mm-hmm.
The situation was so awkward, and it was almost ridiculous, you know, the uncomfortableness that was on him, because he was making all these people inconvenienced. But all he wanted to do was just rest, you know?
Yeah. I think the discomfort that other people feel, I know when I was in the hospital, I thought it was very interesting, because three different pastors came in to see me, not counting the chaplains in the hospital, but there was only one that was really not uncomfortable, and the other two would, you know, kind of wring their hands, put their hands behind their back. They didn't know what to say, and I found it rather humorous at the time, and I tried to put them at ease, you know, but I know the two of them were very uncomfortable, and that happens a lot, especially when you're dealing with something that is so closely related to death, as cancer is.
I think another thing about the listening is being aware of what the person is communicating to you and accepting the non-communication as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had a patient that was dying of a brain tumor who one night, we had a really good talk, but you know, a lot of the time she was out to lunch, seemingly. And when we were talking, she was saying that it bothered her that her family thought that she really didn't know and thought that she was disoriented and everything. And she was saying, yeah, she did. She really was aware of it. And she knew that she had the cancer, but she just couldn't bow to face it and didn't want to look at it. And so, she, you know, so the family didn't understand, you know, was misinterpreting her non-readiness.
Yeah.
And she felt badly that she had to put up a barrier. Anyway, so I guess, you know, I think there's really a time where people want to talk and be listened to, and there's a time where they don't.
Right, and it's good to feel that out when you're dealing with a person. My friend who is in a hospice has relayed, you know, so many times the desire that the person who has cancer has to express these feelings, and the fear that the family has. They don't want to get into it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to let them express their fear. They I guess a lot of people are afraid of tears, and they're afraid of really letting go. And that's kind of sad, because I think that non-acceptance on the part of anyone in the family is a part of the grieving process at first, but then it has to come around to a realizing that this is what's happened, this is what the situation is. And a person who is, say, a person who is dying of cancer, there are things that person needs to express. There are things that person needs to talk about to get ready, to prepare. And it's sad when they're not able to do that with their family, when they have to go outside of the family to do this, to talk.
I took care of my grandmother. She was, I don't know, cancer stories were always real when I went through nursing training and working in the hospital. They're always really more like horror stories. And my grandmother, both my sister and I had lived with my grandmother off and on through growing up and going to college. And we were living with her, and she had first had a mastectomy and then lived 2 years fine without any problems, and then started getting a little jaundice, went back into the doctor, and he said her liver was twice her size, so it had metastasized, and gave her a choice that surgery really wouldn't be much. And she chose that she wanted to stay home, and four of my aunts were nurses, so we all stayed home with her. And just that whole time, it was 2 months, but that whole time that she was able to share with us what life actually was and what death meant to her, and how, you know, glad she was that her time had come. You know, she said, I had such a good life. And she'd come down every day and crochet, and the neighbor kids would come through as usual. And her death wasn't separated from life.
Right, right.
She was a part of life, even dying. And there was just something I learned so much in that we miss a lot of times in a regular hospital situation. We miss being able to give to people that their death is part of
their life
that's still happening. And she'd take each one individually and share one thing more or something, you know. Julia, I wanted to tell you this. Or, you know, my mom, she'd say, you know, until about the end, when she was getting rather perturbed at waking up in the morning and finding out she was still alive. One time my mom woke her up and she looked at us. Oh, Estelle, I thought Jesus took me home. She was so perturbed. You know, we'd go off crying off and on. We went to the whole reading class at the same time. And from that experience has been one of the best experiences in my life. Not a horror story or horrible at all. It was one of the better experiences.
It's that brings me to another point too. When the actual dying process is hidden, and it's not brought to the surface, and it's not allowed to be worked through. To me, that seems it's like when a family doesn't want the person that's dying to know that they have cancer, and that happens, you know, quite frequently, and it's really sad, because that person needs to know what's happening in his life or her life, and they need to be prepared for that. Sometimes I look at cancer as a blessing, because you know you're going to go, and it's not like being in a car accident where you're gone just like that, and you haven't had any time to think or to get your life together or to, you know, really think about the important things of life. Whereas you hear a lot about cancer patients or patients with terminal illnesses who decide that this is it, you know, they have so much time to live. What do they want out of life? And they proceed to live the rest of their life. They don't go into dying, they go into living. And I think something we miss is that living is really a part of dying, and dying is a part of living. And I've come to look at dying as something good, something that happens in the end. When I'm not supposed to be here anymore, then that's when God will take me in. And I feel good about that.
You don't think of all the unfinished business?
Oh, yes, I had a poem like that. I wonder what I did with that. I don't know if I have that with me or not. It's called Now, Lord. And I probably didn't bring that one with me. Nope. Remind me and I'll read that to you sometime. Something that you might enjoy. I came across this not long ago. Something written by Hannah Smith. Slowly you will discover God's love in your suffering. Your heart will begin to approve the whole thing. You will learn from yourself what all the schools in the world could not teach you, the healing action of faith without supporting pleasure. You will feel and understand the ministry of the night, its power to purify, to detach, to humble, to destroy, the fear of death, and what is more important to you at that moment, the fear of life. And you will learn that sometimes pain can do what even joy cannot, such as exposing the vanity of earth, trifles, and filling your heart with the longing for the peace of heaven. I thought that was really a profound kind of a thing. Does anyone else have any comments on...
Carol Steiner says, it's not the end of the road, it's just the bend in the road. Yeah. I heard this one woman say that if you looked at death, or if as a baby you could think about how it was like coming out and coming into this world, and if you looked at death at the same way, it couldn't be any more terrifying than what a baby would be thinking.
Yeah.
What?
Whoa.
Well,
at the other end.
Here I am. Kind of a transition.
Being how you look towards death as being a positive thing, and wondering how you react to the life-sustaining measures in the hospital. Where I had a hard time in pediatrics is, you know, when you're pumping on this kid that is terminally ill and already dead once, and the questions of value of life and, you know, is it fair to force them to come back to a world of IVs and needles?
That's really a difficult situation, and I think each one has its own merits. We had a child whose sibling had died at 3 months of age, and they didn't know what was wrong with the child. This baby at a month exhibited the same symptoms. She was kept in the hospital for her whole life. She didn't ever get to go home. But they kept her alive. There was a point where she would have died naturally. And I really question the ethics sometimes, because they wanted to find out what was wrong with her. And it was something to do with absorption, but they were never able to find out what it was.
Do you feel that having the living will makes any impact if you are in a hospital?
I think that makes it easier, because I've taken care of some patients that where you don't resuscitate, you let them die naturally, and I think it takes a lot of the burden off of you as a nurse. You, not that you wouldn't, you know, want to sustain life if there was that possibility, but you can talk more freely with that patient about, because he knows what's happening to him, and It's a more comfortable situation, particularly in a terminal illness.
Would it keep Dartmouth Medical School is a teaching, of course, it's a teaching institution, and these boys and girls have to learn. And my feeling is, if I ever end up in there, I have it tattooed on my chest, don't take me there. If I ever end up there, I have this living will scattered, my children, the pastor, you know, everywhere. But I have a feeling it's not legal
in the state.
It's not legally binding that they wouldn't recognize it. It isn't the nurse that has to make the decision. Mm-hmm. It's these medical students and interns and residents and not through the hierarchy.
All the doctors that I have worked with have been, for the most part, really good about listening to the family and the person.
Yeah, that's one thing you can consider when choosing a doctor, though. You know, if that's a real...
Well, if you, as I say, if you go into this large, institutionalized teaching hospital, you don't have a doctor.
You have lots of doctors.
And you have lots of medical students who think, gee, this will be great, I learned this out of a textbook, and now I can go to work on her, you know, kind of thing. And I don't know what can prevent that. We had a gentleman in our church, a saint, really, who was taken in with a massive stroke. They resuscitated him twice at night, had him on a machine for 48 hours. A cruel kind of treatment.
Well, are you saying they don't honor those living wills?
It's illegal in our state. I think some states it is
illegal.
It's not illegal, but it's not recognized.
What? Doing a living will, if my understanding is correct, it is a good thing to have as far as supporting the family and the physicians making a decision not to resuscitate.
Right.
In order for the nurse not to resuscitate, there has to be a doctor's order saying do not resuscitate.
Right.
We could be, the families could turn around and sue us if we honored a living will without a doctor's order. But it's, you know, a real hard decision to say that someone else's life shouldn't be saved, especially if they're loved ones.
Well, I think it's real important that you let your family know your feelings and talk about it before things happen. Like my parents already have, since we've been in high school, have sat down at different times and talked to us about what happens if they die and different things and what they want and don't want. And I haven't heard hardly anybody from the medical profession, this makes me really wonder what we're doing. I haven't heard anybody that doesn't want to write like a living will or after going through an experience where they've kept somebody alive and their whole heart says, God, what am I doing this for?
Even back in my day.
That's happened to me with a couple older people. They said, put them on a respirator, and the old lady was ready. I worked with her and I knew in my heart she was ready. But the way the family was approached and they weren't secure enough. And I think this is because we're all pulled apart. We don't know our older people anymore and the older people don't know the younger people. And they weren't secure enough in what she felt and what she wanted. They had just got called in because she was in an emergency. Was real shaky, and the doctor put it to them, like, well, if you love her, this is what you'll do. Mm-hmm. They did it, and in about 24 hours, they all just really were going through guilt, and what am I doing, and this can't be right. She was trying to talk her last words, and couldn't say anything. She was on a respirator, and really awful. So finally, they just came and sat and asked me if I'd sit down and talk with them a while, so I just let them talk through what they really felt, and when it came down to it, they really didn't know what they were getting into at all. And they didn't want it. They wanted to do what was loving and kind, and they thought that this would be it. And they decided then afterwards that they didn't really feel that at all.
What a feeling when you reach that point where you don't control your life. It's probably the most scary thing about it all. Mm-hmm. You have lost control. Mm-hmm. And somebody else can say, I will do this to you, and you can't answer that.
You can't say, No.
That's why people don't want to go.
No. And part of it is just, I think, our own non-acceptance of death, that our society doesn't accept death and doesn't view it as anything positive.
I think the helplessness is a real, I think one of the harder things for me as a nurse, and from what I've seen of families, and I haven't seen it quite so much from a patient perspective, but this person is suffering and you want to do something, you know, it's like a mother wanting to kiss and make it better, and there's nothing you can do, and being confronted with our own humanity and limitation, you know, what do you think of that?
But yeah, that's because you have the idea of medically you should be able to do anything. But there is a thing you can do. You can pray, you can give that person your heart, your feelings, your true self. But there's not a thing you can do as far as medicine goes.
I think Robert Andrews has been talking about this, you know, this past couple of weeks, has mentioned something that's very interesting that about this business of life. He mentions that you must decide about the quality of your life. Do you want to live, or how do you want to live?
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty important. And I think most doctors who are, I don't know what to say, but anyway, I mean, you can talk to your doctor about that. You can let your doctor know how you feel about life. You're not interested in just living. You want to live a life that's got some quality to it. And it takes a month or 10 years, it doesn't matter really. But I thought he was very good about that. He kept telling every section, you know, it's the quality of life that you must decide, not the doctor. You must make that decision.
One thing I wonder about is sitting in a body which I am assuming at this point is in prime health. I'm sitting here thinking, boy, you know, if I were to be in a serious accident and be made a quadriplegic or have X or X or X, I don't want them to save me, I'd rather die. And I could say that to people, and then I wonder, well, when the chips are down, you know, am I going to suddenly view the value of life totally differently and say, well, wait a second, now that you mention it. you know, how do you, you know, where are you? It's hard for me to say in my position, you know, how I would value life if I suddenly felt acutely threatened.
I think there's a point where there, if there is something that can be done that can make a person how do you describe wellness? Well, I don't know if you were here the other night when Mary talked about, say, a quadriplegic. In our society where people, if they're not healthy and have something to offer, they're not really considered valid, or they're not really considered important. I think that that life is worth saving to a point, I suppose, where, like, an older person who has lived a full life, who has cancer, or a younger person for that matter who has cancer, it has taken over their bodies, and then life-sustaining measures are not going to really do much good, because that person is going to die, you know, within maybe a week, 2 weeks. We had a little boy that had Wilms tumor, and that was really tragic. The little boy had been trying to die for months, and he finally stopped breathing, and they resuscitated him. That was tragic. And they resuscitated him because the mother insisted that he be resuscitated. The doctor talked to the parents and finally, you know, convinced them that Peter was trying to die, you know, and the only thing that would really be right would just be to let him die on his own. So within hours he died. But that was really tragic. And you have to think of the person that you're sustaining. I have a little thing. I don't know. This might help in how I feel about the people who are, you know, who have disabilities, who are emotionally or physically handicapped. It's called Jimmy is Crippled. Jimmy's crippled, Lord. He can't move his legs. His head is enlarged. Hydrocephalus, they call it. The doctor said he'd be a burden and wonders if we shouldn't let him die. I don't understand. Isn't that wrong? I can't listen to them, Lord. Even though I brought an imperfect baby into the world, I can't explain my reason for wanting him to live. But I'll stick with my decisions anyway. I know it's right. I'll need you, Lord, more than ever. I'll need you. Help me to accept him and to love him. Jimmy is crippled, Lord. He can't walk, he can't talk, but he fills our home with love. He reveals to us the meaning of becoming like children for you. He teaches us to delight in the little things and shows us miracles every day. Through him we've learned what it means to pray. Thank you, Lord, for Jimmy. I can't imagine life without him. What would the world be like if we had no handicapped children or people to care for? How would we learn mercy, hope, courage? Thank you, Lord, for Jimmy. I usually say things better in short, condensed forms. But I think that, of course, this gets into an entirely different area from dealing with, you know, cancer and its terminal problems to dealing with where do you cut off life, you know, and who's important, whose life is worth saving and whose isn't. That might be a good topic for another forum. Who should live and who should die? Does anyone have any other comments they'd like to make regarding cancer problems that you've had in your own life or in talking with other people or talking with your loved ones?
I wonder if that isn't our big problem. Somebody's dying with cancer and you know it, you want to visit them. What are you going to say? Are we all about safe boots and hairs?
It's an uncomfortable situation, and I don't think there are very many people who don't feel uncomfortable when they're in the presence of someone who they know is dying, and then they know that they're dying. And I think that's where you kind of have to come to terms with how you feel about it. Like Julia, when she was talking about her grandmother, it was probably uncomfortable for them at times to be with her, and yet her attitude toward dying probably improved that a lot.
I think it's just that, and what I learned from it especially is no sense beating around the bush about things, you know. The person knows they're dying, and I think when people, I've been with several people in the hospital who have been really angry after close friends or family have left, and why they were angry was, they know I'm dying, why can't they just let me talk about it? You know, but a lot of times we feel kind of like, well, she'll probably cry, or I'll make her feel bad, or I really don't want to bring it up because she, you know. But I guess from my grandmother I learned that she was able to talk about it in a normal, everyday type of sense, and that because she opened it up for us, then it wasn't something we hid from her or she hid from us. You know, it was just something we all knew, and you know, we talked about it at different times. You know.
But I gather that today, in contrast to 25 and 50 years ago, we don't hesitate talking about cancer. 25, 50 years ago, you did hesitate. Today, it's a common word. You read it, you hear about it, You get all the appeals from the cancer societies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that the word isn't as much taboo, I don't think, as it used to be.
The word isn't taboo, but the feelings that go along with it are often frightening, and people don't really want to get into talking about death and dying. Although death and dying is being talked about so much now, still, you can always be more objective when you're talking about it outside, as long as you're not, you know, really closely involved with it, it's okay. But when it hits you, and when it's right there at your doorstep, and you can't, you know, you can't go this way and can't go that way, you've got to go straight ahead and face it. It takes on a little different light, and you see, you have to deal with some of the feelings that you didn't really want to before, and whereas you might have had a, you know, been able to talk about it, and it's still those feelings don't really come out until you face it. You don't feel the panic, you don't feel the fear and the grief until you're actually face to face with it.
What do you think about people writing books on death and dying?
I think it's good from a hospice kind of a point of view. When people are aware of how someone feels about dying, I think it leads to more openness and discussion, and it leads to more of what, like Julia's experience was with her grandmother. When people can accept death and dying as something that occurs naturally, and they can accept having that person die in their home with them, like they just have grandma stay home and die. I think in Mary's talk on gifts, doesn't she talk about someone who took their mother or grandmother home and took care of them and stayed with them? And that was a very meaningful thing to that person that was dying. And the more open I think people can be and accepting of death in others, I think that's a good thing. I'm not sure where you're coming from on that, whether you're talking about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
I have very feelings about that. Have you read We Live Until We Say Goodbye? Written by Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
I've read some of her things, but not that.
Probably the writings are fine, but my husband's sister, Beth, I think one of the first chapters in the book, the pictures, I didn't go along with it. I know she got permission to print them, but she was a beautiful model at one time, and they were just gruesome. Pictures of a hand, you know, that there wasn't anything left but skin and bones.
What was the thrust of it? What was it supposed to represent?
That's a good question. You know, it's like I say, probably what she quoted, what the sister had said. But that was fine. But as far as putting pictures in,
have you read Donna Hoffman's Yes, Lord?
Donna Hoffman?
Yeah.
Yes.
She was a fairly young mother from locally dying of cancer. She happens to still be living in Toronto, but she deals with her anger and the problems of being a mother with young children and the housework not getting done, and all those problems you go through, the problems that you go through, and people who come and try to tell you you don't get well because you don't have a strong enough faith, and
Oh, yes, that's a good one, yeah.
I think it's very good. It's a series of letters that she had with a pastor friend whom she had not met, but they had met through writing. So they had used some of her poems and poems. And so they have the correspondence that is published up until the time they meet and a little bit beyond. I think it's a beautiful book. I reread it the day I found out that a very good friend had cancer. And,
One of the gals I was talking about, the one that had the daughter with cancer, I was kind of concerned about the feelings that she had. She was really up all the time, and I was concerned about that. I was concerned that she wasn't facing the fact that her daughter had cancer, and they insisted that she was going to be healed. I think that healing is entirely possible. I don't want to misconstrue that, because I believe that the Lord can heal and can heal cancer completely. The only thing that I would be concerned for with them is that if it isn't healed completely, how are they going to accept it, and how are they going to react? Are they still going to be strong in their faith? Are they going to become angry? Are they going to be able to resolve it? You know, I do have concerns about that maybe they're not facing it like they should. Does anybody have any comments about that? I mean, I don't know. I don't really have an answer about that kind of thing. I feel that, you know, I know God heals, and I know God performs miracles in these days.
How is the daughter doing?
She's doing okay now. Mm-hmm. In fact, the last extra X-rays, I think that the tumor had subsided and there was no sign of it. So right now, you know, I'm praising the Lord. I think that, and I'm thanking Him for healing. With cancer, though, it's a little soon to tell, because the irradiation can, you know, diminish it. But then, will it come back? You know, so it's just something to wait and see.
We had a brother-in-law that had cancer, he was sick with it for some time. He knew it, and you know, he thanked the Lord that he had an extension of 1 year of life, and it was really beautiful. I had never noticed to be really witness to the Lord until after he had his cancer. I mean, openly. But he really did. And that year, he made you very conscious of it. And it was a beautiful thing. And he kept working just as long as he could. He wasn't working out, but he was working at home. It was good just to see him, to do the things he still could do. He just didn't give up.
He was living.
He was living. No dying.
Do you do anything to the anti-cancer diet?
Have I done anything with the anti-cancer diet?
Have you done any looking into it?
No, other than I've heard about, you know, some of the aspects of it, but I really haven't. I'm not an oncology nurse. I have thought about joining a hospice team and becoming an oncology nurse. But at this point, I'm still a pediatric nurse.
Do you have any suggestions as to how one... you may meet up with someone that you know has terminal illness, getting them to talk about it?
Well, I think the most important thing is to let them know that you're willing to talk to them. And if they know that they can say anything to you and you're not going to turn around and you know, stiffen up and shudder and not be able to handle it. I mean, if you cry, okay, you know, you that's all right. That's okay. Yeah, in fact, you can put your arms around that person and say, you know, I don't know if you feel like talking to me right now or saying anything, but if you ever want to talk about it, you know, just come and talk to me. You know, I'll be glad to listen to you. And that's almost all a person really needs is some ear. You know, a couple of ears there, and they're willing to talk.
An open invitation to talk. You know?
Open invitation. Yeah, I think that's really important. Just to know that someone is there and available. And they may not want to talk then. They may not want to talk for a while. But then when they do want to talk, they'll know who to go to. It's good to know that there is someone that you can say anything to, and they won't tell you, well, you shouldn't feel that way, or cheer up. You know, that's the last thing you need to hear is cheer up when you're just, you know, lower than a caterpillar.
And you know, I think it's really important to let them know that you're glad you've known them.
Right.
They've been mm-hmm. you know, just to let them know that their life hasn't been worthless.
Yeah, touching, hugs, holding. Some people are not, you know, don't really like to be held. But I think even the person that kind of shuns hugs and doesn't mind being touched, even to just put your hand on a person. I do that a lot in the hospital. I put my hand on my patients, I smile at them, talk to them. You know, even if it's just to say hello and checking on them, I put my hand on them. And it's a way of saying, I do care about you. And, you know, it kind of opens, I don't know, to me it signifies I'm a part of you, I'm another person just like you, and I do care. And by touching a person, I just think it makes me feel a part of them. And I may be wrong, but I think it makes them feel more comfortable. It makes them feel like I am concerned about them. They're just not another body laying there. And it doesn't hurt to have people to pray for you. When I first heard about it, I got on the phone and I called my prayer group and shared. And having someone praying for you, it's like when I went into the hospital for my surgery, there's nothing like going in for surgery to make you feel totally helpless and dependent on people. I mean, when those lights go out, you're just, there you are, you know, and you have absolutely no control over what's happening to you. And knowing that that people were praying for me was probably one of the most comforting things that I could have experienced, because I had so much peace. And that was one of the things I had expressed concern about, was that when I went in for surgery that I would have a peace about it. And I had a tremendous peace about going into surgery. I kept expecting to be nervous and I wasn't. It was really marvelous. But it's good to have people praying for you.